Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to the Great Adjuvant Debate. As today we talk about recent key data sets in the management of melanoma, breast cancer, and non-small cell lung cancer in the adjuvant setting. We have a great faculty today, an interdisciplinary faculty for melanoma. We have Dr. Jeff Weber from the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. For breast cancer, we have Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And in lung cancer, we have Dr. Roy Herbst from the Yale School of Medicine. So as always, if you have any questions or thoughts you'd like to add to this conference, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we can. We're going to put this program out on both video as well as in our podcast series. So for your colleagues who aren't able to attend today, maybe you can recommend for them to check it out. We do webinars all the time now. Tomorrow, we'll be working with Dr. Williams on lymphoma. On Wednesday, Dr. Armstrong on castration-resistant prostate cancer. Thursday, Dr. Weirda from MD Anderson will talk about CLL. Next week, we'll be talking about immunotherapy of lung cancer, our year-in-review program, renal and bladder cancer, and then our AML series on Wednesday, March the 9th. And then we're starting a new series on myelofibrosis on March the 10th with Dr. Verstovic. But today, we're here to talk about adjuvant therapy and to compare notes a little bit about what's been going on, particularly in the past year or so, in terms of these three fields, and really see if we can compare notes a little bit. Now, I met with each one of the faculty separately in the last couple weeks to record their presentation. We'll send you an email when that, as well as the replay of this webinar tonight, is online. But it really would be great to go through that, and if you want to kind of get a comprehensive overview of the data in these three areas. We're going to assume that you already know all that, and today we're really going to try to take it to the next level. Here's where we're heading. I pretty much put together five questions about adjuvant therapy. Questions relate to the questions I'm hearing from general medical oncologists that they hear you all talk about these various issues. And so for each one of these questions, I'm going to ask each of our faculty to comment, give a little mini off the impromptu talk for a couple of minutes, and we'll just sort of see where things head. I call this number one in a series of conferences that I'm hoping to hold. I think we could easily talk about GU cancers and a bunch of other solid tumors. But let's begin and just kind of provide a little bit of an overview of what we're talking about here today. We're going to focus on these three cancers, lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, breast, and melanoma. But keep in mind, there are important adjuvant issues going on, again, in these other cancers. And to kind of set the stage for what we want to talk about today, I want to take you back to when it all kind of got started. It's hard to believe I was even there at the time. It seems more like some movie I saw. But anyhow, I think one of the things that really sparked this was a consensus conference held by the NCI in 1985, consensus on adjuvant therapy of breast cancer. And Richard Pito, who later became knighted for this work, presented the meta-analysis of tamoxifen, which led to its approval. But more importantly, he really introduced a concept that really permeated the field of oncology until now, I would say, and not just in the adjuvant setting. Let me just kind of give you a little bit of a sample of some of the things Richard was talking about in that 1985 presentation.
If you're looking only for big things, then the only things that will contribute towards your aim are exaggerated claims, over-optimistic claims, claims by people who actually are not being realistic about what they can achieve. Every year in the US, there are 400,000 cancer deaths, roughly. Of these, about 40,000 involve breast cancer. Now, realistically, the kinds of change that you're going to hear described, the kinds of trials that you're going to hear described, might, if we're lucky, involve avoidance, let's say, of 4,000 of those 40,000 deaths. Now, avoidance of 4,000 deaths is humanly worthwhile. I mean, there's nowhere near 4,000 people in this auditorium, and avoidance of the instant deaths of all of us would certainly be worthwhile. But it's a small percentage, and it's very difficult to pick out those kinds of small percentage. And so you've really got to get very accurate, very sensitive, large randomized trials.
And so, Sarah, you know, one of the issues that comes up here that when he presented this, he was talking about the how you need events in order to have statistical, you know, benefit. Is what about, so a lot of times high-risk patients get put in trials so you have more events. But one of the issues is going to be, what about people who are sort of under the bar? And one of the principles that he brought out was this idea of relative risk reduction going all the way down into node negative and beyond. And a lot of times this goes beyond FDA indications, et cetera. Any thoughts about this type of thinking in the adjuvant setting, Sarah, and how it applies to breast cancer?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very important question. You know, clearly the whole goal of adjuvant therapy is to help prevent recurrence. And so your question is, how low do you go in terms of risk to really figure out which patients all really need adjuvant systemic therapy? And how can you measure that? Because I think your point is a good one. If you're going to look at lower risk patients, their absolute event rate is going to be very low. And sometimes risks will come into play, even if you do a large study. You know, their risk of having deaths from other cause may be higher than their risk from dying from breast cancer per se. And so actually, it's interesting. We just convened a STEEP 2.0 panel to help better understand how do you measure events in an adjuvant trial in a low-risk population, and what's the appropriate endpoint to help you capture the events you're really trying to prevent and not be diluted out by events that, you know, can happen from other competing risks. So it's a tough question.
And Roy, you know, in the past, there was the adjuvant online model that was used a lot, particularly in breast cancer, and gave you quantitative estimates. And one of the issues that was so valuable there was they, as Sarah was alluding to, if you put in the patient age, the competing cause of mortality was factored in. So when you get to people who are 80, 85 years old, that became a very significant factor. And in lung cancer, you have a lot of people with comorbidities, smoking-related issues, et cetera. Any thoughts about how you kind of integrate all these together as you try to make a decision, Roy?
Right. We actually used Adjuvant Online in lung cancer a bit as well for the same reason. Again, you know, in the chemotherapy that we use in lung cancer in the adjuvant setting, after many large trials, a meta-analysis became standard of care about 15 plus years ago. Of course, the benefits there, you know, survival benefits on the order of 5% or so, you know, small, but certainly greater benefit, you know, in patients of higher risk. So yes, you know, one has to look at the risks of the therapy, the risks of comorbidities, and that's a discussion that one has to have with a patient. So tools like the Adjuvant Online and others were always very helpful to us in trying to say, well, you've got stage 3 disease, so your risk is a bit more than if you have stage 1 or so forth.
So before we get into the 10 phase 3 trials, most of which have come out in the last year or so that we're going to talk about in these three cancers, one other point I just sort of want to get out on the table, Jeff, is the issue of patient involvement in the decision-making. Adjuvant therapy is kind of strange in that the primary benefit really is a number. As Roy was just saying, you're reducing a risk, but you know, tumors don't shrink, patients don't feel better, a lot of them end up feeling worse. And these are challenging decisions. A lot of times the benefit in an absolute level is fairly minimal. You may be in a situation where most of the patients are actually not going to have their course changed by the therapy in some situations. I'm curious, and I think melanoma really is kind of a leading edge in some of the new concept, particularly IOs. How, you know, the patient's perspective on risk and benefits factors into adjuvant decision-making in melanoma, Jeff?
Well, interestingly, Neil, it depends to some degree on where you live. When I was at Moffitt, which is in Florida, a lot of patients would hear our case for or against adjuvant therapy, and they would say, "Doc, you make the decision." In New York, I can guarantee it's not that way. Everybody has his own or her own preconceived notion of what an acceptable risk would be. And our job here at this institution often is to provide the information the patients need. And then we sit down and say, what do you think? What kind of person are you? Are you the person who would accept X percent risk for Y percent benefit? Or do you think that that's not appropriate? And I try to make a parable or an analogy for them and tell them a little brief story about risk-taking. And some patients will want to take risks, some patients will not want to take risks. And part of our job is to get a feel from that eyeball-to-eyeball interaction with the patient. Which category do they fit into? Are they the person who would accept any reasonable risk just for a 1% advantage in relapse for your overall survival? Or is it the type of person where it's just not worth it unless there's a big, significant gain? So that's how we get involved with our patients.
And you know, Sarah, it's interesting because in breast cancer, I think there was a study from Australia, again, I think it was like a million years ago, where they asked people who had been through adjuvant therapy, what would it take for you to go through it again? And there was a significant fraction of people who were willing to go through therapy for very, very minimal risk. A lot of people walked away thinking that women are more aggressive about wanting therapy. We did a very similar study about 10 years later, again, I don't even remember when it was, in colon cancer. We found the same thing, that these are people who had adjuvant therapy. There was a fraction, I think about 30%, who would go through it again for a 1% reduction in recurrence rate. And 10% of the people who, I think it was 20% of the people wouldn't go through it for a 10% absolute benefit. So again, huge spectrum. But the thing that was interesting, Sarah, was it was the same in men and women. Curious what your thoughts are. Yeah, well, you know, I guess it's the issue, again, what's your philosophy about medical intervention? Any thoughts?
I mean, it's interesting. I see a practice that's predominantly almost all women, but I do see this very discordant view from different patients. You know, there, as you point out, and I think this is really important to assess when you're making these decisions, is, you know, as Jeff and Roy said, you want to provide them data about what their absolute benefit is going to be from taking this therapy and tell them what the potential risks are. And you'll see that some people are, again, willing to take therapy for the 1 or 2% benefit, whereas others really want a much larger benefit. But again, that is so critical to understand so that, you know, you're making a decision with them that they're doing what they feel most comfortable with.
But Neil, in the risk-taking scenario, I think it is it not always true that in multiple studies, the physicians, usually the academic physicians, will have a certain threshold for benefit, and it's much lower for most patients. A lot of patients would accept a 1% benefit, whereas the physicians, got to be at least 10, if not more, percent. So I think we tend to overestimate the benefit that we should be seeing, whereas the patients will go way low.
Well, we're just trying to sort of introduce these concepts today. Again, I envision a whole series. Incidentally, this is, for those of you who are not aware of it, this is a book that used to be published every 2 years starting in 1977 called Adjuvant Therapy of Cancer. Doctors Sid Salmon and Steve Jones started this. It went on for about 20 years. People would show up in Arizona, do their presentation, and 4 months later, they'd have a book. I guess things change a little bit. All right, let's go through the data sets and kind of get into more granularity about what's going on in these three fields. I'm going to start out with you, Roy, in a second. We'll just overview the key trials and sort of how it... The first question I want to ask the three of you, an audience, I've come up with 5 questions that I'm going to ask all three of these docs, and we're going to kind of go... The first thing I want to hear about from Roy is how these trials, and the two trials in particular was last year in ASCO, how they affected what's going on in your interdisciplinary decision-making, particularly your tumor boards with pathologists, surgeons, rad-oncs. How has it affected your approach to biomarker assessment? What are some of the controversial scenarios over this past year that you've gotten into? How much is the neoadjuvant versus adjuvant question coming up in your tumor boards? In breast cancer, we have this really interesting strategy where post-neoadjuvant treatment was used to a greater advantage. We're now seeing that in GI cancers. Is that something you think is relevant? And then finally, any role you see for cell-free DNA as moving forward to help with decision-making. So, Roy, the key trials here, we have the ADORA study with a spectacular hazard ratio for recurrence, no survival yet. And we have the EMPOWER study in the adjuvant setting, but we also have the CheckMate study in the neoadjuvant setting using nivolumab plus chemotherapy. And now, according to a press release, showing disease-free survival advantage. So, Roy, can you provide an overview of how these trials, just a snapshot, have affected your kind of decision-making, the discussions, what's going on in your interdisciplinary meetings?
Well, sure. So what we've seen, Neil, is that our best therapies, our targeted therapies and our immunotherapy have moved up to early disease, as they should, and that's where they'll have the most benefit. So EGFR inhibitors first went into clinical trial in lung cancer around 1996. It took about 4 or 5 years until EGFR mutations were identified. Then, of course, the agents moved to frontline. We're now in the third generation of EGFR inhibitors. That's the drug osimertinib, which is an EGFR mutation tyrosine kinase specific agent. So it's less toxic than anything that came before it, not perfect. And it also has good penetration into the brain. So what's changed in the last year is the fact that the trial ADAURA, which began, by the way, over 7 years ago, was designed to take this drug and use it in patients who had had their tumors completely resected, stages 1 to 3 lung tumors, and a randomized trial, as you can see here, to the osimertinib, 80 milligrams a day versus placebo. Many people ask, how can you do a placebo trial? Because there was no standard of care here. In these mutant patients, they got chemotherapy or not, depending on a decision between the patient and the physician, and of course their stage. And then they would just watch.
Can you just sort of, you know, I think most people, most of our audience are familiar with the basic stuff, and I think they can go through your talk for the details. What I want to know is what's going on in your interdisciplinary meetings. How is it affected? For example, you had this really interesting neoadjuvant study using an IO neoadjuvant with chemo, but you also have this a trial with an approval in the adjuvant setting. How's that playing out?
Well, for the EGFR, you know, biomarkers matter. So in the person with a resected cancer at tumor board, which we have here every Monday morning, we want to know, is the patient EGFR mutated or not? Why? Because if they are and they're stage 1 to 3, they could be a candidate after chemotherapy, although that's a decision they make with their physician. They would be a candidate either for the osimertinib or for observation. So now we're talking about it. We're discussing it with our patients. We're preparing the patients for this when they get their chemotherapy so that they know that they can have this drug, which has an 83% chance of preventing of improving disease-free survival, and these patients, you know, metastasize to brain, liver, bone, and other. And for the immunotherapy, based on EMPOWER-10, we now know that in patients with stage 2 and 3 disease, if they're PD-L1 positive, so someone's going to ask a tumor board after a resection, is this patient PD-L1 positive? Because we need to know that, because if they're greater than 1% PD-L1, those patients then become a candidate if they have stage 2 or 3 disease for atezolizumab in the adjuvant setting. So these are things that happen at tumor board. And then what's really exciting now is we look at a tumor and say, should we do adjuvant neoadjuvant therapy? And the CheckMate 816 showed incredible improvement in MPR rate, PR rate by pathology with these agents. Not an approved therapy yet, but it's moving forward. As you mentioned, the event-free survival was positive. Actually, I think just today as we speak, I saw that the FDA granted this a priority review. So we're moving in the direction of taking immunotherapy and targeted therapy, in this case, EGFR, that I would predict soon other agents earlier in the disease, using them in the adjuvant setting, not without toxicity. As you mentioned, when you compare something to nothing, there's going to be some side effect, but to improve and decrease the recurrence of disease. Survival studies, by the way, are pending on all of these.
So I want to go back to Jeff in terms of neoadjuvant therapy. One of the things that Roy was commenting on there is that the type of surgery, there was less pneumonectomies after neoadjuvant therapy. We'd already seen that with breast cancer, a better chance at lumpectomy after neoadjuvant therapy. Jeff, is there a reason or a strategy or patients where neoadjuvant therapy theoretically would be beneficial with melanoma, or does the current paradigm work for most patients?
Well, neoadjuvant therapy has generated a lot of excitement in the melanoma business over the last couple of years because there have been a handful of small studies not having any arm with more than 30 patients. But in those studies, which have included what we call flip dose ipi-nivo with ipilimumab at a low dose, nivolumab at a higher dose, for just 2 treatments, 2 cycles, 6 weeks, or nivolumab with LAG-3 antibody relatlimab, which is, again, two cycles, 8 weeks, four weeks apart. There was more than a 50% rate of either a path CR and more like a 60% rate of major response, major path response, meaning 90% response or a complete response, where those patients then went on to get, in some cases, no further therapy. And at modest levels of follow-up, like 2 years, they had almost a zero rate of relapse. So everyone got really excited, and there was a lot of vibes about let's design some trials. So there have been a couple of trials designed with neoadjuvant, and if you get an MPR, major path response, 90% pathologic disappearance of tumor in your lymph nodal specimen that comes out at the time of lymph node removal, that you don't do anything further. And if you do have residual disease, you get further adjuvant therapy, or you balance that against just a standard surgery plus adjuvant therapy. At the end of the day, it may be just that neoadjuvant therapy picks out the good actors so that the overall RFS will not be different, but it's worth a look, and there's a lot of excitement. The only downside from my point of view is we don't see very many patients with palpable nodal disease anymore. Most patients with melanoma that have stage 3C disease, which is, you know, pretty high risk of relapse, have sentinel node or microscopic only disease and would never be palpable or even show up on a CAT scan. The other interesting thing is the CAT scan data from these trials show that most of the time you don't have much of a change in the appearance of the lymph nodes on a CAT scan, but if you section them, you can get a very high response rate. So the radiologic response rate, much less than the actual pathologic response rate. So a lot of excitement. And for a small group of patients, I think it might be very useful.
So, you know, I always think about our work as being based on rounds. I'm just kind of imagining making rounds with the three of you. I think that could be a pretty interesting experience. Let's flip over to breast cancer and see what's going on there. And hopefully, by the end of this, we'll come up with maybe some new thoughts. So, Sarah, I put up there HER2 positive, just sort of, I don't want to really talk about it a lot today. I just wanted to put up there sort of the Catherine strategy, as Jeff was just talking about. But the three huge trials that came out now in the last year or so, CDK inhibitor, the MONARCH E study, abemaciclib. So for patients already getting hormonal therapy, adding CDK as it's been done in the metastatic setting. PARP inhibitors, as we've seen in ovarian cancer, now post-neoadjuvant, adjuvant from the Olympia study. And finally, checkpoint inhibitors in triple-negative breast cancer, the KEYNOTE trial, looking at neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy. So again, if you sort of take a step back, Sarah, and think about sort of some of the discussions that have occurred in the past year in your interdisciplinary meetings, I'm curious what some of the key topics are. I know one must be in terms of biomarker assessment. You have Key 67 as an issue now, all of a sudden, in Obama. And then, of course, you have the whole issue of HRD and BRCA, et cetera. How has it affected the way you look at a tissue? Of course, you're an academic center. And how has it affected your interdisciplinary discussions, Sarah?
Yeah, no, it's had a lot of impact because, in truth, we were not testing Ki-67 routinely in patients with ER-positive disease, and yet we saw the approval come out, at least in the U.S., for abemaciclib, that is for patients of high Ki-67. And so I'll say our group had a lot of concerns about that approval, one, because Ki-67 is not a very well-replicated biomarker, particularly in the range in which the approval is based on, and because, in fact, Ki-67 was not a biomarker predictor of benefit in this trial. And so while there is an approval that is based on Ki-67, there's been now guidelines put out by ASCO and NCCN that do not mandate using Ki-67. So I'll say our group has not been making decisions based on Ki-67 for use of abemaciclib. But I think, you know, other biomarker issues that come up is obviously with the Olympia data, we now really do need to be getting germline BRCA testing in our adjuvant patients, particularly the high-risk patients really do need to make sure you're getting germline testing. But it brings up a lot of questions, and these are the questions that come up at our tumor board. Well, what if someone has a germline PALB2 mutation? And those patients weren't part of Olympia. Should they be getting a year of adjuvant olaparib? I don't think we'll ever actually get data for how to address that rare patient population. It'd be too hard to do such a study, but we know they do seem to see similar benefits in the metastatic setting. So maybe it's not unreasonable to think about in those patients. And then with KEYNOTE-522, PD-L1 was not a biomarker to predict benefit to checkpoint, which was a little surprising to us given the data we had in the metastatic setting where it is a clear biomarker predictor. And right now we don't have any biomarker predictor for immunotherapy for our early stage triple negative patients, which is a challenge because these agents do have toxicity and we'd love to figure out which patients really need it. So, you know, lots of questions that really have arisen from these data.
So again, just to kind of get the data out on the table, Jeff, these are the trials and more that you reviewed in your talk. And one of the issues that comes up, and maybe you can just briefly comment on kind of where the data has been leading us the last couple of years, but an important issue that you commented on in your presentation is the issue of course, highly debatable, you know, disease-free survival versus overall survival. And one of the things that's really notable in terms of these trials is how the issue of crossover comes up and how it affects your ability to look at survival. How has that played out in melanoma and how has it affected your discussions with patients, Jeff?
Well, in melanoma, as in any cancer, if you have an adjuvant study of drug or drugs versus placebo, and those drugs are not going to be available anytime soon to the placebo patients, I think survival is a really good endpoint. Obviously, relapse-free survival, if it's superior to placebo, is great. But if the other if the drug's not available, you should see a survival advantage. Again, with CheckMate 238, that was not the case, meaning you neither saw a survival advantage, but that was because of the inherent crossover, because at the time the study was done, as we've discussed, each drug was available if you failed the other. So if you failed ipi or ipilimumab, you could get nivolumab treatment. If you failed nivolumab, you could get ipilimumab treatment. So anytime there's an inherent crossover, survival falls out as a quantifiable or useful endpoint. And I think the FDA knows that. They understand that. RFS is generally an acceptable endpoint for an adjuvant study. In the COMBI-AD study, which was a placebo-controlled trial of dabrafenib, trametinib versus no treatment, you couldn't get dabrafenib and trametinib easily in most places the trial was done. It was mostly done ex-US. If you relapsed and had unresectable disease, which is what happened most of the time. So there, initially at only, I think it was 2.5 years of follow-up, there was a survival advantage. We haven't seen any follow-up survival data. I'm sure it'll be coming out soon. I would predict there will be a true survival advantage and a plateau in that study. Going forward, now that we have lots of useful melanoma drugs available everywhere in the world, I don't think you're ever going to see a placebo-controlled trial, number one. Number two, you're never going to see any survival advantage. So it's simply going to fall out as a quantifiable endpoint.
So I'm going to go into another question in this second module here in terms of, I'm curious how you describe benefits of therapy to patients. So we'll start out again with Roy. And what I'm really curious about is to what extent will you be willing to provide numbers to patients, you know, numeracy, like adjuvant online? And how do you take the relative risk reduction that you see in a trial? So Roy, for example, the relative risk reduction for recurrence with osimertinib was, you know, spectacular, you know, about 80%, you know, 0.2 or maybe even a little bit better. How do you take that and sit down with a patient, let's say, who has a 50% chance of recurrence? And if they're in, I mean, we've had patients presented of medical oncologists who were in this scenario as patients. How would you explain it to this very knowledgeable person about how you convert the trial data into their specific benefit? And will you offer numbers to patients?
I would, you know, so for the osimertinib, you're right. The hazard ratio for the primary endpoint stage 2-3 was 0.17. So I would say you have an 83% reduction in risk of disease recurrence. There are no survival data available. Those are pending. But what I do point out is that the morbidity of recurrence. So, you know, patients that recur with EGFR mutant disease tend to recur in the brain, liver, bone. So we actually, in our first report, when I saw the data initially, I knew it, you know, I expected this trial to be positive. But when I saw that there was an 88% decrease in the recurrence in brain disease. Again, early analysis, we're going to update it this year. That's the type of thing that I talk to the patient about. But I have to be realistic. You know, it's taking a drug. It's not a placebo. There will be some rash. There will be some GI side effects. And occasionally a patient might end up with some interstitial lung disease. Good thing in the trial, no one died from it, at least so far in the initial cut of data. But still, it's something that one has to be worried about. So I talk to them about that in a balanced way. For the immunotherapy, which we've been using a little bit less long because those data came out just late last year, I say you've got a hazard ratio of 0.6 or so. So you got about a 40% reduction in recurrence. Again, no survival data yet. My sense is with immunotherapy, there probably will be even a longer durability, but we don't have any data there. But then again, there are risks to it. So I have to say, you could have a pneumonitis or a colitis. So you have to balance it between the two. But I think, in that case, everyone had chemotherapy in that trial. So they've already had the standard of care. With a targeted therapy, there's often a choice whether patients will have the chemotherapy or not. I always tell the patient, take the chemotherapy. That has the survival benefit. That has at least a 5% or more improvement in survival. And then I will sort of try to give them an absolute number based on their stage.
So just to sort of bring it down a little bit more, and I will say too, that ADORA study, it was the incidence of brain mets was 10% versus 1%. And, makes a lot of sense in terms of morbidity. That's great for 10% of patients, at least initially being able to avoid that experience. But Sarah, I'm curious how you people talk about relative risk reduction and absolute, and yet a lot of times I feel like I'm not sure that message is getting home to a patient. So if you have a patient who has a 50% chance of recurrence, and then on top of that, you lay an adjuvant therapy on that, let's say, in this case, has an 80% relative risk reduction, well, you can sort of multiply, 0.8 times 50, but it's not quite that way. Then you got to sort of slide that out. But Sarah, the real issue is when you have a patient who's at low risk, 10%, how you take that relative risk reduction and apply it there. Any comments and any thoughts about, do you see fellows and other people kind of getting that confused?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I think it is very confusing. I remember as a fellow being confused by it. So I think it's tough. And I think one thing it's important to remember is patients don't really understand, first of all, what a recurrence means. So I think it's really important to lay that out for them that, in breast cancer, sometimes women mistakenly think most of what I'm worried about is cancer coming back in their breast or their contralateral breast. But in truth, what I'm more worried about is them having a distant recurrence, right? And I think that's really important for them to understand what is a recurrence, what am I worried about, and what does it mean to have a recurrence? Because if you have a distant recurrence in breast cancer, unfortunately, it's not something that we can usually cure. And so that means that this is likely going to eventually become a life-threatening problem. And I don't think patients always understand, again, what a recurrence really means. And so I think it's really important to convey what you're talking about clearly. And then I think, as was pointed out, I usually write down on a piece of paper, this is what I think your risk of recurrence is. Then I put a little arrow and I say, this is what it will drop down to if you take drug X. And so I do put in the absolute change and what the actual number is for what I think their risk of recurrence will be after that therapy. But then I think it's equally important to weigh that against the cost, right? With immunotherapy, there's a risk of lifelong toxicities, 20% of women are going to end up hypothyroidist, 5% may have adrenal insufficiency. These are usually lifelong toxicities. We don't know impact on fertility, right, for young women. So these are important costs that you have to lay out next to the benefit. And again, I think it's an involved and complicated discussion.
It also leads into another question, Jeff, and it was so interesting the way this evolved in melanoma because it was a big, I think it was an ESMO meeting where you were presenting and like all of a sudden this stuff hit. And it looked, and you go through your talk, it looked indirectly like the benefit in the BRAF patients was about the same indirectly with IO or BRAF. And so we'll talk about the issue of toxicity. Of course, that's a very important issue. But what about, sort of durability, the ability to cure? I showed the durvalumab locally advanced trial in lung because that's got five-year data. I mean, I would call that adjuvant. It's consolidation after chemo radiation. And the curves are staying apart. I can tell you, Dr. Wakely, I remember when I talked to her right after the presentation, she had that in her mind, was less convinced that, you know, a targeted therapy would have a long-lasting benefit. And this has been debated back and forth in melanoma now for a few years, Jeff. Any sense whether the chance for cure might be better with immunotherapy or not?
Well, if you look at the data from COMBI-AD and you do the back-of-the-napkin calculation to compare it to the stage 3B3C group from CheckMate 238 or KEYNOTE-054, which is the only valid comparison, right? Because the trials all had different types of patients. There were 3A, B, C in COMBI-AD. There were only 3B, 3C, and 4 in CheckMate 238. So if you sort of take the 3Bs and the 3Cs, it's really close. If you look at the overall RFS curve from COMBI-AD at 5 years, it looks like it's a real plateau. If you look at the overall RFS curve from CheckMate 238 at 5 years, it looks like there's a real plateau. And those plateaus are not in the same location, because in the COMBI-AD, you had better outcome patients, 20% at 3A, whereas none of those good outcome patients were in CheckMate 238. But if you do the back of the napkin calculation, which the statisticians will have a stroke over, there might be a couple of points better outcome on that plateau with Nivo or even Pembro. With KEYNOTE-054, there's not enough long-term five-year data yet for Pembro, so I didn't include it. But A, what surprised me is there's definitely a plateau with COMBI-AD. Everyone figured, oh yeah, everyone's going to eventually progress. Not true. With targeted therapy, dabrafenib, trametinib, BRAF-MEK drugs, at 5 years, you've reached a plateau on that RFS curve. That's impressive. Maybe it's a little lower if you do the back of the napkin calculations to compare the 3B3Cs, but that's very dangerous. And again, the statisticians have a stroke over it. But I will take the highest risk patients and generally go with immunotherapy. I will take the medium and lower risk patients and go with targeted therapy. I'll always try to put them on a trial, which these days is almost all IO in melanoma. It's not targeted for reasons I'm not quite clear on. I don't know why. But I know one institution that's very close to us, because one of the individuals on the call is at that institution, where the melanoma docs don't believe in adjuvant IO therapy. They just always will use targeted therapy because they don't want any permanent side effects. And Sarah's right. There is a definite rate of permanent endocrinopathies, which means you'll take Synthroid for the rest of your life. And there's that 0.2% chance in any histology, by the way, not just melanoma, of getting type 1 diabetes, which is devastating. So, but that, you have to present that very carefully to the patients as the risk.
So, yeah, the last AML program we did last week, the first case was a patient who'd gotten niraparib for ovarian cancer and multiple lines of chemotherapy, secondary AML. And that really leads us into the next thing I just want to touch on, because, you know, you can talk about the benefits, but it has to be considered within the context of the risk, of the risks of therapy. We're not even going to get into financial issues, but particularly in terms of serious toxicities, long-term toxicities, quality of life issues. And there's a real spectrum of these agents, these 10 trials here that we're talking about. But just to kind of provide an overview of some of the scenarios and just kind of what your discussions, again, with patients are like. Sarah, I want to start out with you, because I think one of the most interesting is in triple-negative breast cancer in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting, when you have a patient who also has, let's say, a BRCA mutation. So you've got PARP inhibitors, you've got IO, you've got previous studies with capecitabine post-neoadjuvant to consider. You could use all three, you could use two. How do you think that through, and where does the toxicity issues come in as you try to make that decision?
It's a tough problem because we don't really have data to answer this question. Really, because of the way KEYNOTE-522 was designed, it didn't adapt that adjuvant therapy based on your response to the pre-op therapy. And as we've heard from our colleagues, that is a movement we're really moving towards, as we use that pre-op treatment to see if they have a good response. And if they haven't, it gives us an opportunity to give more, but that wasn't done in that trial. Everyone just got Pembro out back. But as you point out, we do like to use olaparib if someone has residual triple negative disease and is germline BRCA mutant, or capecitabine if they have residual disease and are BRCA wild type. So then how do I figure out, do I give both drugs or do I choose to give one? And I think the truth is, while I don't know the right answer, I do know that the residual disease patients have very high risk of recurrence. And so I still want to try to optimize that. And in truth, what I've done is not purely data-driven, but I've recommended giving capecitabine with pembrolizumab to the BRCA wild type patients, and for the BRCA mutant patients, giving olaparib with pembrolizumab, so merging the two trials, if you will. But as you point out, there's toxicity issues. We do have safety for doing that based on other trials that have looked at combination therapy. And in truth, the patients continuing the pembro are patients who've already kind of passed the test of not having a lot of immune-related toxicities if we're considering giving them additional therapy. So usually the immune-related toxicity factor is a little bit lower, given that, again, they would have stopped it if they had already developed significant IO tox. So again, that's the way I've approached it. There doesn't seem to be a lot of synergistic tox by giving both agents together.
And, you know, another issue is adherence. You know, we have these trials that have the data based on the way the trials are done, and then the adherence within the trials, which a lot more eyes on patients, et cetera. Roy, I'm curious what it's been like to try to integrate osimertinib. It's, you know, has a reputation of being a lot easier on patients than the early generation agents, but now you're going to be taking it for quite a while. How do you see adherence going with osimertinib? What are some of the challenges you think are going to be going on? Again, you have a patient too, adjuvant versus metastatic, different maybe mindset. Any thoughts, Roy?
Oh, absolutely. 3 years of therapy, you know, and even though it's, you know, a more targeted drug and it's it is better, you are still going to see side effects. They tend to be low grade, but, you know, a couple of percent of patients will have significant rash or diarrhea. So you have to, you know, coax them through it. You have to treat those side effects. Sometimes you have to dose reduce. So these are all issues to consider, especially in the absence of the survival data. Some patients will say, no, that's, it's not worth it. You know, I don't want to do it. My feeling is, though, that remember, in stage 2 and 3 lung cancer, the recurrence rates can be as high as 50%, 70%, 80%. You know, this is a big risk. And if you happen to have the mutation, and remember, this is a small group of patients, you know, about 10% of the population, I'm still, you know, I still will try to discuss this with them in a positive way to be treated. But there are side effects, and I have had patients who have had to stop because of the side effects or take breaks. So it is something to think about. And then for the immune therapy, that's stage 2 and 3 disease. And as we've heard from Sarah and Jeff, you know, that also, you know, those do have those permanent side effects. Some of them, other side effects can be reversible. Patients have to realize that there are those risks, and you discuss it very carefully, and you talk about how to mitigate those risks beforehand so that they're prepared when they develop, so that they'll call or they'll have some things on hand to treat them.
So, Jeff, I want to bring you in terms of the issue of oral therapy. Obviously, the BRAF strategy is oral. And there you have maybe some significant issues, fevers, et cetera. I'm also curious what you do if after a few months the patient's really not happy. Would you switch to an IO, or do you try to sort of stick with what you start with?
Oh, I would absolutely switch. We've had a modest number of patients who started out on dabrafenib and trametinib. And as you know, one of the problematic side effects is you can get these bizarre episodic febrile fatigue episodes where you just feel terrible, you can't get out of bed, you feel miserable, and it always passes. The problem is every once in a while it just keeps cyclically coming back and coming back, and patients will just say, forget it. I've had steroids, I've had Motrin, Tylenol, I just like, I'm sick of this, I don't want to do it. And they'll just say, I want to stop. And I'll put them on immunotherapy, I'm fine with that. And it goes the other way. Sometimes you can't tolerate IO therapy, and I'll put them on Dabtrem. Although I'll say one interesting thing that I've noticed is that the people who do the latter have done spectacularly, and the people who go the other way, not quite as good. Meaning if you fail IO either for toxicity or you relapse and get re-resected and then go on targeted therapy, those patients have done very well. Now, in the metastatic mode, those are the patients who do very well if you sequence treatment. Whereas if you sequence targeted then IO, the patients don't do as well. So it makes you wonder, and actually we're going to put together those data and figure out if that's a real observation or not.
So just sort of flashing on the issue of IOs as adjuvant therapy in terms of how you think through that. It's an issue with all three. I want to know what kind of history, you have to kind of think a little bit about the benefit before you answer the question. What kind of history would get you to not use an adjuvant IO? I'm going to start with Sarah. So Sarah, you know, we think about, now we're talking triple negative disease, you think about the positive impact that it appears to have at this point. What kind of history will get you to say, no, I don't think so? I mean, the issues that we talk about are prior transplant, solid organ transplant, for example, a prior autoimmune disease, either something like psoriasis versus multiple sclerosis, somebody on therapy versus not. What will get you to sort of drop the Pembro for triple negative, Sarah?
Well, one thing I will say just to keep in mind, in breast cancer, our approval is really in the preoperative phase. And I will say we're not sure what the benefit is for a purely adjuvant patient. And so most of us are not giving someone adjuvant Pembro who went straight to surgery. So I will say that's one reason I would not give it, is also if they didn't get it in the preoperative phase, because I don't know the benefit in someone who didn't get it preoperatively. But in terms of contraindications, you know, I think this is one we struggle a bit with, because, you know, there is some data certainly that with autoimmune diseases, many people actually do fine with checkpoint inhibition. And so, you know, I have been willing to give patients, you know, who have psoriasis and things like that, Pembro. I will say I've been much more nervous if someone has an uncontrolled autoimmune disease, though. That's where I will not feel comfortable challenging. And certainly I've never given it to someone with a transplant before, but I'm guessing some of my colleagues have. So, you know, I will say that in breast cancer, again, that is a contraindication to us where we don't have quite as much experience.
Well, you know, of course, one of the challenges of adjuvant therapy in general is that a certain number of these people are cured before you ever give them anything. So it makes it a little more problematic to introduce a you know, problematic therapy. Roy, again, adjuvant use of IO at this point in non-small cell, it's adjuvant Atezo. We've had Durva out there. What kind of history will get you to sort of skip that?
Well, first of all, the Durva data are fantastic. So we try to give it to everyone. I would agree also with survival there. For the Atezo in stage 2 and 3, I think you have to be a bit more careful. But yeah, I would agree with Sarah. If someone has an autoimmune disease, they've required long-term steroids of some sort, I try to avoid that. Certainly you wouldn't want to give it to someone with MS or some other problem. Tremendously poor performance status. I don't think you'd be giving someone anything, chemo or immune therapy. Organ transplant, you know, we talk about it. Certainly, you wouldn't want to give it to a heart transplant patient, but occasionally it's discussed if someone's a renal transplant, if you have no other options. But I think in those cases, I would avoid it. You know, we're talking adjuvant therapy here, not metastatic disease. When you get to the metastatic setting, you know, I think we would all agree you probably don't want to leave IO on the table if you can avoid it, because certainly in lung cancer, I've been doing this quite a while, that's the only way to see some long-term benefit. But, you know, not in people with those contraindications.
Curious, Jeff, how you think this one through. Very different with BRAF versus wild type, because with BRAF you have an alternative, and wild type either going to give IO or not. Is the benefit enough to get you to use it in people with prior autoimmune disease?
To me, it's of course a risk benefit analysis. You'd have to convince me that someone has a very high risk of relapse, way over 50%. Before I'd even think about it in a patient with autoimmune disease. If someone has active autoimmune disease and is steroid dependent, forget it. It makes no sense to me. If someone is taking methotrexate and or mycophenolic acid and or infliximab or whatever other drugs, that to me is a sign that you probably should refrain from using IO therapy. But I, for example, saw a new patient today from another institution. She had psoriatic arthritis and she was given adjuvant Pembro. She had pretty high risk disease. And she had modest symptoms of her psoriatic arthritis. And of course, what happened when she got 5 doses of Pembro? She flared and had to stop. So most patients who have active autoimmune disease, even steroid dependent, but just active symptomatic, at least a third, if not a half of them, will definitely flare when you give them a single PD-1 drug. And I'm sure that's true in breast cancer, lung cancer, melanoma, et cetera, renal cancer, wherever you are. So I think you have to be very, very careful. I would absolutely not treat someone who requires active significant immunosuppression with an IO drug. Remember, as Roy just said, some of those patients are cured just sitting there in front of you. It's very difficult to justify a worsening and flaring a major league disease like lupus or RA or MS when there's a decent chance that patients may be cured.
Incidentally, I forgot to show you this before. This is the audio program that I made with Richard Pito. I don't know if the millennials in the audience, this is actually a cassette tape. Probably never seen one, let alone a CD. I don't think they've even seen CDs. We still, literally, I swear, we still have people saying, please send us the CDs. I'm not sure where they're playing them, but anyhow. Okay. Another issue I want to get your thoughts on, and then I really want to kind of get your thoughts about where things might be heading in the future, and also just curious about your thoughts. I'm audience, curious about your thoughts about this experience here today, and you know whether it'd be interesting to maybe extend it and develop it. I want to bring up the issue of brain mets, Sarah, and I think you know Roy referred to the what was seen in the trial with osimertinib, and certainly brain mets are a very important issue in all three of these diseases. But in HER2-positive disease, which again, we're not really focused on that much today because nothing new, at least in the adjuvant setting, has come about, although we've seen some amazing data in the metastatic setting that I think clearly is going to affect adjuvant therapy. But there, Sarah, you hear a lot of thinking about brain mets and maybe adding another drug. There's a TKI, tucatinib, that has a lot of brain activity. I'm going to ask all three of you, but I'm going to start with you, Sarah, in terms of the issue of where brain mets fit in terms of the design and execution of adjuvant trials in breast cancer.
It's an important question because, as you point out, you know, at least in HER2-positive disease, we saw, you know, trials like Catherine show 50% reduction in rates of recurrence, but have absolutely no impact on rates of CNS recurrence, which, you know, was very disappointing. There is still about a 5% rate of CNS relapse in that trial. And so, you know, it is an area that we do need to improve on. And so, as you point out, one such strategy that one could take is trying to add something like a novel TKI, such as tucatinib, which has great CNS penetration and CNS activity, to an ADC like T-DM1, and see if that not only helps prevent recurrence in general, systemically, but also help prevent CNS events. And so, you know, it is something that is, I think is important because we need to prevent the recurrences everywhere, you know, including in the brain, particularly in cancers where that risk is high enough to warrant thinking about a CNS strategy.
Jeff, what about in melanoma? Of course, you know, we've seen a lot of great activity of immunotherapy in metastatic disease. What are we seeing in the adjuvant trials in terms of adjuvant therapies preventing the development of brain mets?
That's a good question. I would say there's still a significant rate of brain relapse in patients who've been on adjuvant Pembro or Nevo and dabrafenib and trametinib. That being said, what interested me was when I did my original IST, which was the only first and only adjuvant Nevo trial done before the big randomized study. I think we had 31 patients and 10 of them had resected brain mets. And only one of those patients ever relapsed over time, and that was like 5 years. So I think adjuvant therapy can be effective in treating resected brain mets, especially if they've been resected and stereotactically radiated to kill the tumor bed. But in terms of once you are a year, 2 years, 3 years out, the rate of relapse in the brain still is fairly significant. It's not as high in melanoma as the rate of all patients who develop brain mets, which is very high. But yes, you still see a significant rate of relapse in the brain, and the percentage isn't that much different from arm to arm of the adjuvant studies.
Roy, what about in lung cancer? We mentioned osimertinib. What do we know about the impact of checkpoint inhibitors in the brain? Your colleague, Sarah Goldberg, has done a lot of work on this in metastatic disease. Do we know right now whether IOs prevent brain mets, Roy?
Well, you know, we had a good collaboration here, as Jeff knows, between Sarah Goldberg and Harriet Kluger, so our melanoma and our lung group. And yes, you know, pembrolizumab in an IST they did long ago did have activity on small brain mets. This is going to be important to look at as we have more mature data from a number of the adjuvant trials that are coming forward. You know, the tezolizumab is just the first, the Empower 10 of two or three adjuvant trials that we'll probably see later this year. And that is going to be something to look at. I haven't noticed anything yet, but certainly that would be a very important finding and a reason to recommend this to patients as we wait more for the survival data.
So another sort of common thread, I think, that goes through these and other situations in the adjuvant setting. We were talking before about the fact that the trials often include higher risk patients so they can have more events and get the trial done quicker. But then you get the results back and you say, well, what about people who are at lower risk? Can we apply the relative risk reduction on top of their absolute risk, although they might not have been in the trial? So Sarah, any thoughts about that as you, again, sort of think about the numbers that are accumulating every year in breast cancer?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I think it's tricky because as you get, as you pointed out, as you get into these lower risk populations, the absolute benefit is going to be smaller. And you're taking some of these regimens that are pretty extensive regimens that do carry quite a bit of toxicity risk. And so shifting them into that lower risk setting, I think, has to be very thoughtfully considered. And in truth, we don't know that those benefits will always translate. And there may be something biologically different about the smaller tumors where they may not have as much benefit. And so I'll say this is coming up now, particularly, for example, with the abemaciclib approval. You know, that was really geared to a very high risk population, four or more positive nodes, or if you're 1 to 3, had a really big tumor or high grade. But what about all those tumors that it, you know, neglected? So what about the smaller cancers that have 1 to 3 positive nodes? Would you still see a 30% reduction in IDFS events? And is it worth it with the toxicity costs? And what about stage 1 triple negative disease? Should Pembro be used in that setting? And, you know, I'll say it's not, I'm not taking those data and applying it to the lower risk setting because, again, that absolute benefit is smaller. And without having data to know that, you know, there's really going to be benefit, I have not sort of used the slippery slope and migrated it down without any data.
So we're in the arena of patients who you think would benefit, but maybe don't fall into the key trial. And Roy, one of the most interesting phenomena that we've seen in this past year is a difference in how general oncologists look at the adjuvant lung data and how investigators do, because oncologists a lot of times don't want to give the chemo. They just want to give either the atezo by itself and a particularly lower risk, or they want to give osimertinib without chemo. And then you all say, well, the trial was done with chemo, or, you know, certainly the osimertinib trial. Any thoughts about deviating, if you could, Roy, from the actual trial design and approval into these other arenas, either lower risk or skipping one of the therapies?
Well, for the immunotherapy, everyone got chemotherapy in that trial. Remember, chemotherapy for lung cancer improves survival. There are numerous trials, there are meta-analyses. So I wouldn't skip that at this point. And who knows, the chemotherapy might have some important effect in the immunotherapy working, as we know from other studies. So certainly I would not skip it there. With a small molecule, that gets even more tricky. The 1B patients had a hazard of 0.5, meeting significance. 1B lung cancer patients, 80%+ of them are probably cured. So that's a group where some people are saying, should we even give the chemo and maybe just give the drug? We have to wait. As the data mature, we'll see if we have enough patients to look at that. Probably needs another trial. And then you have the 1As, the really small tumors. That you'd have to extrapolate. I would say we need to watch and be careful there and probably do another study, which is actually being planned right now.
So, Jeff, you know, going back to adjuvant tamoxifen, you know, adjuvant tamoxifen is used like as a 1 millimeter tumor. It doesn't matter. They don't care. They apply it and they consider the risk not that great. Just kind of curious how you think all these numbers through, Jeff, in the melanoma scenario.
Well, the melanoma scenario has one very interesting recently matured trial, KEYNOTE-716, which treated stage 2B or 2C patients with pembrolizumab for a year or placebo. And that was a positive study only after about 20 months of follow-up, by the way. Even though stage 2B patients do very well, their risk of relapse at 5 years is around 25% max. The bizarre thing is the 2Cs, who have a much higher risk of relapse, 40%+, maybe 50% even, the hazard ratio for improvement in relapse-free survival was much better for the earlier phase 2Bs than the worst outcome 2Cs. And everyone looked at this and they said, what? That doesn't make sense. So here's an example where going earlier back, I mean, there's a big difference between a 2B and a 2C. 2Bs do well, 2Cs do not. It's where you're actually getting better adjuvant benefit with IO in an earlier and better outcome patient than in a later outcome or a later patient with a worse outcome. So go figure. And over time, the hazard ratio has improved somewhat, but at the end of the day, I think you're going to have a much better hazard ratio for RFS in the better outcome earlier patients in stage two melanoma. So most unusual.
So I want to just conclude and allow each of you to just briefly comment on one arena that you think you're excited about in terms of current and ongoing trials, either a specific trial or a concept. We're getting tons of questions in the chat room about cell-free DNA as a thought, but I'm just maybe just your thoughts about that, starting with you, Sarah. Anything that you're excited about for the future, any role for cell-free DNA in adjuvant therapy of breast cancer?
Well, in terms of the future, I'm definitely excited about ADCs moving into the early disease space, where I do think it would be a nice way to try to mitigate toxicity and use highly efficacious agents to better cure our patients. But I think the question about ctDNA in breast is a really important one. And while not ready for prime time yet, I do think in the future, as these assays get a little bit more sensitive and specific, it can be a game changer. Because right now, we don't know who's cured and who's not. We're just giving adjuvant therapy based on clinical risk. But if we can actually figure out which patients actually need additional therapy in a more refined way, that will change things. And so hopefully ctDNA will be the way to the future to do that, just not quite ready right now in breast cancer.
So Roy, your thoughts in terms of new directions? And a very common question I've seen a couple in the chat room already is, are we going to do the ADORA trial for every one of these mutations? You guys are already up to 8 or 9 first-line targeted therapies. Are we going to have to do that, or can we just take the paradigm and go ahead?
Well, first of all, ctDNA, I was going to mention that we need that. We treated people for 3 years on ADORA. Is that too little? Not enough? We don't know, because we could measure in the blood what's going on. That's all ongoing now. So I think we'll learn a lot about that, why patients become resistant. Some patients might have been resistant from the get-go and maybe might need another drug. For the immune therapy, we have to personalize immunotherapy. Right now, we're clearly benefiting some patients, but not all. Hazard ratio is only 0.6. Again, who's at the most risk? ctDNA, and then to follow and see who's responding. So I think that definitely has to be done. So that's going to be the future. Higher risk groups and understanding if the drugs are working, if they're primary resistant or acquiring resistance. But then you ask, we talked about this just at our lung meeting the other day. All the targets we have now, do we have to do a big randomized phase 3 for every one? I would hope not. Perhaps some sort of master protocol. But I would think that if we can get our ctDNA and other techniques down, and again, toxicity has to be demonstrated with some of these agents. I think with some of the drugs that really target addicted drivers, like RET, for example, I think there might be possibilities of moving these forward, maybe with large, more phase 2 trials or trials where fewer people are treated with the placebo. That's something we have to look at.
I always love to do poll questions with the lung people where we go, if you could, would you give a RET inhibitor in the adjuvant setting? And then 60% of the audience says yes, and then the investigators have a hypertensive crisis there. But anyhow,
I'm not recommending it.
So final comment from Jeff, again, in terms of cell-free DNA, in terms of new strategies, what do you think is going to be the bigger changes that are going to occur in melanoma in the neoadjuvant-adjuvant setting over the next couple of years?
Well, I'll just say the changes will be things like new drugs like LAG-3, bembegaldesleukin or NKTR-214 being combined with PD-1 blockade in an adjuvant strategy. I think that those will be the new developments. We desperately need biomarkers. You can't continue, as in CheckMate 716, it was estimated when it was presented at ESMO that you'd have to treat 11 patients to benefit one. There's only so much money in this country, and you can't continue to treat 11 patients to benefit one. I think we're going to have to pick out the worst actors with biomarkers, and right now there isn't a good biomarker or a consolidated biomarker in melanoma for IO therapy. PD-L1 is deficient as a biomarker. It is not a very good one. And finally, ctDNA, the problem with stage 3 melanoma is not enough of the patients are going to be positive on ctDNA assays after resection. So it's hard to find enough positives that zero convert. The zero converters are always going to do well. That's great. The non-zero converters are going to do badly. The problem is if your baseline positivity is really low, it doesn't help you. So we need better assays.
So Sarah, Roy, and Jeff, thank you so much for participating in this phase one CME experiment. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back tomorrow. We'll see what Dr. Williams has to say about mantle cell. Roy, you were saying you just took your boards. I don't know if on your boards we're going to get into which BTK inhibitor you use in mantle cell and can you use it up front and when you use CAR-T. I'm not sure if that was on the last boards or not, but I don't think so. Anyhow, thanks again. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.